Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week in more than 112 countries over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on education versus indoctrination when we come back. You know, with an income of $50,000 a year, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes if you're self-employed. Well, then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income and then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of that same $50,000 twice? But you know, the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of the $50,000 in Social Security tax once. Then they make you pay 17% of the same $50,000 in income tax twice. Now that means that you pay 17% of that $7,650 Social Security tax twice. And that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from you and from everyone else that pays that tax. What would you think if Sears or Penny's or your credit card company charged you twice, like Social Security and the IRS does? Now, isn't that just real special? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, call us here at the law school. The number is 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's the place to start. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. Now, tax and status, our school is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for your free general law CD package. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we're talking about education versus indoctrination. Now, when we take a look at what the distinctions are between the two, and education is the presentation of information and an acceptance or rejection of it. We have a number of dictionary definitions. It's, for instance, the education is the inculcation of the values and beliefs of the older generation upon the younger generation. Yeah, that's probably true, but that's indoctrination. Indoctrination is where we take a particular view and we tell you that view, and this is the view that you're to believe. I went to catechism, and I was indoctrinated into the Missouri Synod of the Lutheran Church. I mean, this is what we believe. It's not, is this what we believe the truth? Is this what we believe something that comes from authority in the Scripture? No, it's, this is what we believe, and that's what those guys believe, and those guys are wrong. Why are they wrong? Well, because they don't believe what we believe. Well, why is it that what we believe is correct and what they believe is wrong? Well, because we believe it. Well, that's what everybody does. And so everybody's indoctrinated into their religious ideology. And now we've extended that indoctrination technique or that program into our education. We superimpose it upon science now. And that's not science. And science is the investigation of that of which or from which or to which or with which we do not know. And we want to find out. So we eat off of the tree that is forbidden to us to find out what happens. And then when we find out, we have now been educated. We had a choice to make. And we made the choice. Sometimes the choice is the wrong choice, but that's what education is all about. Education is predicated upon free choice. And indeed, sometimes the wrong free choice. But the minute you take free choice away, you don't have education, you've got indoctrination. Now, I'm not here to persuade or convince you that I'm right. I'm just here to deliver information. You can decide for yourself whether the information is true, accurate, or correct. I don't need to tell you. I don't need to say this is what we believe. I don't know what the hell you believe. You can believe whatever you want. But by the same token, if you don't have all of the relevant facts, well, then how can you come to a conclusion as to what you should or should not believe? Now, all of the relevant facts require information, and the information that you receive, much of it's going to be false. Juries, you know, are oftentimes called upon to make a decision concerning somebody's liberty or his freedom. Are we going to convict this guy and lock him up, or are we going to exonerate him and cut him loose? And so we sit here in deliberations and we come to a conclusion. We analyze what people have said, and what they haven't said sometimes comes into play. And sometimes juries make a mistake and convict innocent people. Sometimes they make a mistake and release guilty people. But they have to make an educated guess. It's a determination based upon facts and input. Then we come to a conclusion. Sometimes the conclusion's erroneous. That's the way life is. Now, I don't question what people believe, and in their minds, what they believe is the truth, whatever this mysterious truth is. In science, we come upon the truth based upon the results that we receive from investigation or scientific experimentation. And we rely upon the ability of other interested persons to duplicate our experiment. And if they come up with the same results, then we call that truth because it's verifiable. That's what works. That's the way that game is played. Now, in the Bible, that's what we see as the modality for education. The Bible prescribes a legal education rather than a liberal arts education. Here in America, and I suspect in most countries of the world, the state is attempting to give all of their citizens a liberal arts education. In the Bible, God, that is the creator of the heavens and the earth, writing in the scripture, is attempting to give everybody a legal education. From that legal education, if you'd like to pursue a liberal arts education, that's your choice in life, but number one has to be law. Now, of course, law requires a lot of work. Oh my God. That's why there aren't very many lawyers. I mean, you got all kinds of people running around out there that can unfold like a rose and have all kinds of social ideas and can ballet and do, you know, they can do all kinds of crazy things out here that don't amount to toots in the world when, you know, like sculpture and art, if that's what you can call it. But a legal education requires talent, dedication, requires a tremendous amount of work. A medical education requires a tremendous amount of work. And the best and the brightest, the smartest of our citizens become doctors and lawyers. So God, you know, in his estimation of things, looked around and he said, you know, in order for people to really be happy, healthy, smart, have good street sense, they've got to have a legal education. Medicine's good, but if we had a good legal education, we wouldn't get sick, therefore we wouldn't need medicine. Now, oftentimes people, they kind of sneer at law. I'm a law school teacher, so I come into contact with people quite often, and people that are interested in law, they get interested, and they really want to learn, but oftentimes their wives or husbands, who aren't interested at all, they sneer at it. In fact, they're kind of rude and obnoxious. I don't know if it's this law school. Maybe it's just this law school. If they went to some other law school, they might not think so lowly of it, but that's been my experience over the years, is that people, generally speaking, don't care much for law. And preachers don't care much for law. They care about religion. They're not really too concerned about law. This guy, Zach Montgomery, he's concerned about education. He says what we're degenerating into back in 1886 is indoctrination rather than education. The changing of definitions in the dictionary, the changing of parental authority from parents to the teacher is despotism. That's headed to indoctrination. That doesn't have anything to do with education. So I thought I'd point this out to you again. We mentioned it in the first program here, but in the morals, in life, we have to have morals. And they're teaching morals in the public school. And the morals of sex education in the public school, where they're teaching 14-year-old children to have sexual education, practice free sex, sodomy, lesbianism, or abortion, so that's morality. And as a general rule, if you just take people out here, you know, you take Mormon parents, they would not teach their daughters to be whores or their sons to be sodomites, all things being equal. Neither would Catholics or Muslims or most anybody else. Now, of course, the lesbians and the sodomites and the whores probably would. Now, here's something that's a conundrum. You see, we, that is the straight people, years ago, we took a look at all of these other people and we said, well, that's bad. Therefore, we need to do something about that. Now, you need to understand, you Mormon parents out there, that if you all get together and you give somebody power to decide morality for somebody else, you can rest assured that same person that's deciding that other guy's morality over there is going to decide yours. And that's where the government stepped in. They said, well, we're going to decide what morality is and is not. And so now morality in this country is decided in the public school. Fortunately, in this country, under our form of government, you don't have to send your child to public school. You have to educate, and we have compulsory education. That comes from God himself. God, the creator of the universe, he requires compulsory education. No two ways about it. And he requires a compulsory legal education based upon the standards and laws of the scripture, the laws that he set down at Mount Sinai. That's his requirement. And he says anything other than that's crime, period. And that crime is going to be punished. And he's been doing that for a long time. He says he's going to continue on. If that's what you want, stay with it. Hell, you're on the right track. You want to get punished by that God, you just keep doing what you're doing, and you can rest assured that it's coming to a city near you. Now, thinking people would like to avoid that punishment, which is why in the scripture it says, hear in fear. You know, you take a guy out and you stone him to death in the public square so that everybody can see this guy die, see the blood. running down his face, down his cheeks, off of his chest, watch him expire. That'd send a pretty strong message to anybody, unless your brain did. And so we took a look at that and we said, well, we don't like that. We want to change that. And so we got busy and we started changing that law. So we changed from illegal education to liberal arts. And we came to the conclusion that happy, successful people have to be engineers, or they have to be lawyers or doctors, or they have to be something out here that can make a lot of money. That's the modality that we follow here today. God never said that you needed to have an education to make money. He said you needed an education to function in the world. That's what a legal education does. Solomon asked for a legal education. God said that that was very wise of him. He said, I'm going to give you this wisdom that you're seeking over here. I'm going to give you this legal education, son. And he did. Solomon, as a result of that, made a lot of money. Now, lawyers, as a general rule, aren't very poor people. You get a legal education, money will fall. A legal education, money follows that legal education. And that's because it's pretty hard to screw a lawyer. It happens once in a while, and we all cheer when it happens. But it's not very often that you're going to get into a lawyer's back pocket. And that's because he's pretty street savvy. You know, he knows the law, and he's pretty savvy. When he reads the contract, he says, oh, no, I'm not signing that. First of all, a lawyer has to learn to read. And with a legal education, you'd have to learn to read. And if you would, and Abraham Lincoln did this. Now, Abraham Lincoln was a lawyer. Abraham Lincoln had a legal education. He learned to read from the Bible. That's the textbook that he used to learn to read from. And most educated people in olden times, you know, before we got onto this anti-parental kick over here, like people used to be educated out of the Scripture. They were pretty knowledgeable in the Scripture. They were pretty knowledgeable about scriptural law, scriptural doctrine. So today, we are just abysmal ignoramuses when it comes to the Bible. So Zach Montgomery, the guy that wrote the book here now, the Poison Drops in the Federal Senate, and said, let's analyze, let's take apart this anti-parental school system so that we can understand it. I think that's a good idea. In law, we call this code pleading. Let's take this law apart and let's understand this law. We want to know who wrote it. Why did he write it? What's the purpose behind it? How does it benefit us? How does it harm us? What's good about it? Should we keep it or should we reject it? It's called the anti-parental school system dissected and analyzed. He begins by saying, should we wish to ascertain the exact character and properties of the waters of our great Pacific Ocean, we would not undertake to analyze the whole ocean. That would be an endless task. But we would take up at most a few ounces of this water, and then after making a thorough analysis of it, we would announce the result as indicating the properties and character of the waters of the Pacific. And so it is if we would make a careful and reliable analysis of the essential principles and elements which go to make up what is known as the public school system. If we were to undertake to subject to an analytical test, the whole system with its entire paraphernalia, teachers, pupils, parents, school directors, school teachers, school books, school funds, school houses as they exist throughout the country, we should become amazed and bewildered at the magnitude of our undertaking and would probably abandon the enterprise in despair. So let us take from this very large mass of school material a small quantity of its essential elements, just enough to be handled with ease and examined with care, and then we shall be the better able to see what is the character of the ingredients which go to make up the system. Now, in order that you, good reader, may not accuse us of unfairness in our selection of the particular sample to be analyzed, we will allow you to choose your own material. Then, why don't you cast your eyes around among your friends and neighbors, and then name for us two of the very best, two of the purest, two of the most intelligent, two highly educated and reliable men of your acquaintance. Then, let them be men of your own religion. Let them belong to the same political party as you yourself belong. In a word, let them be two men to whom you, in preference to all others in the world, you would be willing to entrust the guardianship of that beautiful little 7-year-old girl of yours, should it please God to take you and your mother, or her mother rather, away from her during her years of childhood. Now these two friends of yours, whom we shall call A and B, we shall take it for granted, are the very best material to be found in that great mass of voters who control by their votes the destinies and the shape and character of the public school system as it exists in your city today. Now, let's suppose that these two model men and neighbors of yours should someday come to your house and address you in this regard. Mr. C., we are informed that you are the father of a bright, beautiful, and intelligent little 7-year-old girl, just the proper age to begin her education. Now, we feel quite anxious that she should be properly educated, and to tell you the plain truth, we are afraid that if we leave the matter entirely up to you, her education will be neglected. So here's what we propose to do, Mr. C. We propose that we, your two best friends, together with you yourself, shall all enter into a written contract, binding ourselves during your daughter's minority to contribute annually a certain percentage upon the assessed value of our property, which shall constitute a fund for the education of this, your little daughter. But it must at the same time, and it must in the same contract be stipulated that it shall be at all times in the power of a majority of us three to select the teachers and the school books for your child. And should you, against the wishes and without the consent of a majority of us, take your child away and send her to some other school, you must agree to forfeit, should we choose to exact it, not exceeding $20 for the first offense and not less than $20 for each subsequent repetition thereof. And, Mr. C., you must also agree and bind yourself in advance not to withhold your assessment, even should you withdraw your child from the school of your selection, because we should, in that event, need the money for the education of other children. Now, tell us, my friends, would you ever consent, while living and in possession of your reasoning faculties, to entrust such a power as this over your child, whether a boy or a girl, to any two men in existence on planet Earth? Would you not spurn such a proposition as the above with indignant scorn, come from what source it might? Now, we may here remark in passing that it surely could not better the matter should these supposed friends and neighbors, in consideration of this proposed outrageous betrayal of your parental trust, even offer to perpetrate a similar wrong against their own children by turning over to you, the insulted father, a corresponding share in their parental authority. And yet, my friend, this miniature picture, which we have just drawn of the public school system, presents that system in its very best possible aspect. Because we have represented to you, sir, the father, or mother, as still allowed to retain in your own hands one-third of that parental jurisdiction and control which the God of nature requires you to exercise over your child, while the other two-thirds are to be entrusted to two of the very best men in the whole community. But you see, my friend, under the public school system as it is, by law established, instead of retaining in your own hands even so much as one-third of your parental authority, you retain only an infinitesimal fraction thereof. Where there are, as in San Francisco, tens of thousands of voters, each father divides his parental authority into tens of thousands of equal fragments, retaining but one of these fragments for himself, while the great bulk of this authority, instead of being lodged, as in the case above, supposed in two of the very best men to be found in our city, is scattered around broadcast amongst tens of thousands of people, good, bad, and indifferent. This parental authority is gobbled up and wielded by every rough and every rake who is allowed to vote. And this is what they call our great American free school system. It is, in fact, the 10th plank to the Communist Manifesto, and those who attempt a justification of this monstrous usurpation of parental authority never fail to entrench themselves behind the hackneyed and much-abused maxim that the majority has the right to rule. But there are some things in which the majority has no right to rule. For example, the majority has no right to select for a man his religion. Neither has the majority a right to choose for a man his wife, nor does the majority have a right for a woman to choose the husband who is to become a parent of his or her children. Now, the teacher of a child is simply a person who, for the time being, acts as a substitute for the parents. But if a majority has no right to select the principal, then what on earth right has that majority to select the substitute? So, in other words, if the majority doesn't have a right to force a man or a woman who aspires to become the father or the mother of the child in the first place to marry a spouse to whom he or she may object on the ground that such a spouse may be pernicious or may be raucous or may be in some other way bad, a bad example, would corrupt the children of such a marriage or poison their minds and hearts against the objecting party, then in the name of consistency and common sense, then what right has this same majority to accomplish the self-same and even worse result by selecting the teacher to take the place of both parents, a person who is as distasteful to them and who may imperil and destroy the health, the lives and honor, the virtue and the final affection of their children, as well as their own peace of mind, without in any way being held responsible to them or either of them for this conduct? I tell you, boys and girls, pay attention. Let's wake up and smell the coffee, because that's precisely what we have all done. You see, when you vote for this politician or that politician, you vote for the public school system. All these politicians are in favor of this public school system. Name one that isn't. Name one. Send me an email. There isn't any politician anywhere that I have heard that's opposed to this process or this program. Everybody's in favor of public school. Now, let's go back here a step or two. Let's suppose that all of us are sitting over here and none of us are Mormons. And over here, all of us are observing two Mormons, a man and a woman. And we all come to the conclusion that those Mormons are morally unfit parents. Well, then don't we have the power to take their children away from them and put those Mormon children into an environment that we all approve of? All right. I think you'll all concede that, yes, indeed, we do have that power. And indeed, we have been exercising it. In fact, as I speak right now down in Texas, they have taken 400 and some odd children away from a bunch of parents down there because they're Mormons, some sect of Mormonism, and the state disagrees with the way those children are being raised and educated and being morally trained. And indeed, we have that power. Now, let's put the shoe on the other foot. Let's suppose that that Mormon parent over there, he bands together with all the rest of this majority over here against you. And after all, what's good for the goose is sauce for the gander, ain't it? So let's suppose all of those people get together and they take a look at you and the way you're raising your children and they say, you know, that Gordon over there, we don't approve of his morals. We don't approve of his religion. We don't approve of his politics. We don't approve of that guy in any regard. And he's got little children over there that he's raising and he's going to teach and train them to be just as objectionable as he is. Therefore, we should take those children away from Gordon. And then we should educate those Gordon children to the standards that we all subject ourselves to. Now, boys and girls, that's precisely what we've done, whether we're Mormons or Baptists or Catholics or etc. Now, let me propose to you a wild new concept here that we used to follow in this country. It's called the Fifth Commandment. The Fifth Commandment, honor your father and mother. We used to practice a system here where the Mormon parents over there raised their Mormon kid in their Mormon morality, in their Mormon religion, as wrong and as objectionable and as obnoxious as their religion and their morals may be to all of the rest of us. But we just leave them alone, but out. And then when they got all through raising those kids over there, those Mormons turned out to be Mormons with Mormon philosophy and Mormon ideology and Mormon morals. All right. And then the Baptists, let's try them for a minute. What if we just left the Baptists alone and butted out and let them educate their children to their religion and their ideologies and so on, as repugnant as their theology and ideologies and morals may be to all the rest of us? And then let's just do that for the Catholics and the Muslims and everybody else in the world and butt out and leave those people alone. What do you think the result would be? What would happen? Well, let me start off by asking, how does the Mormon religion or how does the Mormon morality over here impact upon you? Well, if the Mormon kid comes over, hits you over the head and steals your purse, if the Mormon kid burglarizes your house, if the Muslim kid over here kills you, if the Catholic kid over here burns you at the stake, then you've got a bitch, you've got something, you've lost your life, your liberty, your property, you've lost something to them. Well, isn't that where we're at today? I mean, isn't that our problem? Isn't that our crime problem today? Well, was there ever a time when we didn't have that problem? Well, yeah, we didn't have that problem in 1850. In the southern states, they practiced the system of parental supervision over their children. They practiced parental education. Everybody butted out. And you just let everybody raise his kid the way he wanted to raise his kid. Some of those parents were whores, raising little girls, and more likely they turned them into whores. But by and large, you're going to find in society that most people, no matter what their religion, no matter what their politics, are opposed to theft. They're opposed to idolatry. They're opposed to licentiousness. They're opposed to raping and robbing and pillaging, and they're opposed to hedonistic society and adultery and fornication and so on. Most. And as a result of that, in the southern states, they had very little crime. They had very little insanity, suicide, murder, welfare, paupers or poor, and virtually no unemployment as a result of just butting out and leaving people alone. Now, the reason that we're butting in and not leaving people alone is for money, power, control. We need to destroy the family so that we can control the people. You can't control people that are controlled by families. So what we need to do is to get rid of the families and then put them into an educational institution where we control the curriculum and we can turn out carbon copies on a mass scale. And that's what we've done. Hang on, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily over the internet and radio. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults in compact disc And the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives, and that can also be accessed through our webpage at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, newsletters, to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that those authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour and editorial review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember our webpage is georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing the book, Poison Drops in the American Senate by Zach Montgomery. Let me give you the information again. It's reprinted by St. Thomas Press. You might be able to get it. It may be in print. They may still be in operation, but it was last printed in 1983, so we're talking about, 24 years ago, 25 years ago now. And the St. Thomas Press, their post office box used to be 35096, Houston, Texas, 77235. Again, that's St. Thomas Press, post office box 35096, 35096, Houston, Texas, 77235. Now, you might also look at Gibson Brothers Printers and Book Binders. When you go into a used bookstore, you might be able to find this by putting in the Poison Drops in the Federal Senate. Put that in the computer. Then you put in the author, Zach Montgomery, spelled Z-A-C-H Montgomery. Now, they don't use Zachary here, so they're just using Zach. And then if you were to put in Gibson Brothers Printers and Book Binders, 1886, you might be able to come up with that somewhere. Now, meanwhile, back on the farm here. Those who attempt a justification of this monstrous usurpation of parental authority never fail to entrench themselves behind the hackneyed and much-abused maxim that the majority has the right to rule. Now, that's what we're selling now around the world. We are telling people around the world that we Americans are in favor of democracy, and we're pushing democracy, and we're going to war to bring democracy to everyone out there. Now, there's a result that comes from that, a result. You wring your nose, you get blood, Solomon said. Well, in Chapter 10, here's a voice from San Quentin, California's educated convicts. All the younger criminals can read and write. Two more penitentiaries necessary to accommodate Massachusetts public school pupils, California public schools, the high road to the penitentiary. How the one serves as a preparatory department for the other. The public school prepares and educates the criminal for his lifelong career in the penitentiary. Now, the following is from resident director, Lieutenant Governor Johnson, the biennial report showing the condition of the California State Prison and state prisoners for the 2 years ending June 30th, 1877. This report under the caption of Education says, Turnkeys Table Number 7, showing the educational abilities of the inmates of the prison, gives the number who can read and write at 985, read but not write at 24, neither read nor write at 309. Now, if we consider the number of Chinese and Indians in our prisoners who can neither read nor write and then deduct them from the whole number so as to match our whites and Negroes against the same in other states, it will be found that ours possesses the advantage in a large degree. In fact, among the younger convicts, they can all read and write. Now, the turnkey table number 3 shows that the number of Chinamen in the state prison is 197. So if we deduct this 197 from the entire number of convicts who can neither read nor write, it leaves just 112 who can neither read nor write against 985 who can both read and write. Then again, from this 112, there remains still to be deducted the Indians, whose number is not given in the turnkey table. But the most startling revelation contained in the above extract is found in the concluding sentence, which says, in fact, among the younger convicts, they can all read and write. You got that, boys and girls? Let's underline that. In fact, among the younger convicts, they can all read and write. Now, remember Montgomery's thesis here is that the more money you spend on public education, the more crime you're going to have. And I showed you from the recent experience, well, 1979, fairly recent, among the Amish people in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, there are no Amish people locked up in their state penitentiary. There are no Amish people who are on welfare. There are no Amish people locked up in their insane asylums. And there are no unemployed Amish people in Wisconsin. But when you look at the ranks of the unemployed, the criminals, the paupers, the insane, and the suicides and murders, all of them, every single one, has been educated in the public school system. All right, now keeping that in mind. Now, the younger convicts, as appears from the turnkey table number 6, there are some 253, but 21 years old or under, while there are 831 under 30 years old. But while our young state is making such rapid strides in the way of forcing her boys first into her anti-parental schools and then into her penitentiaries, her great exemplar, Massachusetts, it would seem, is not neglectful of her laurels either. The regular Boston correspondent of the San Francisco Morning Call, under the date of November the 16th, 1877, says this, quote, "The rapid progress of knowledge peculiar to the educational system of this state has led to the erection of two more state prisons, one of which is for women and was successfully opened a few days ago, the number of wicked females who knocked for admission being 44. Present indications point toward the rapid filling up of this new institution in just a few months." Now, I want to point out, boys and girls, that in the Bible there are no prisons at all. We don't even use the penitentiary system for punishment. There's punishment. Oh, don't you think for a moment that there aren't punishments in the Bible. 24 activities warrant the capital punishment, death, and 28, I believe it is, or 26 punishments. 26 different things that can happen to you for the violation of the laws of the Scripture. Going on, Mr. Montgomery points out, we're constantly told by the friends and admirers of our anti-parental educational system that it is much better and more economical for the state to expend money for schools and schoolhouses than for jails and penitentiaries. Hey, let me pause right here and mention that. Have you heard that too? Hell, I've heard that all my life. We should be expending more money for public education. And in that way, we will be spending less money on prisons and jails. Now, that's what we have been indoctrinated to believe. But the statistics and the facts show us exactly the opposite. The more money you spend on public education, the more crime you have. It has been that way since 1850. When we got after this public school thing hot and heavy. Now, taking the foregoing figures as a basis of calculation, it would be a very interesting process, and it would doubtless lead to most important results if some admirer of our present educational system, who is a good calculator, would make an estimate in dollars and cents of the amount of money saved to the state of California per annum of that kind of education, which is sustained by a cost of more than $2.5 million a year, and which sends to the state prison its hundreds of beardless boys, while total illiteracy, which we all lament as a great evil, sends not so much as one solitary boy to that popular institution. Now listen, pay attention here. This is 1877. These are the statistics that Montgomery pulled together. He said, listen, in San Quentin prison, there's 900 and some odd prisoners in there, and they divided them out as to the white population who could read and write. And they found out just exactly the same thing they found out among the Amish in Wisconsin. Every single one of them has been to public school and can read and write, and ain't got one illiterate in there that's white. Not one. Same thing you get with the Amish. Now, I'm not so sure that not being able to read and write is good or bad. Now, let's think about it for a minute. I told you about my old mentor, Frank Rocha. Came to this country in 1922. He's 22 years old. He was born in 1900, died in 1971. He couldn't read and couldn't write. When he died, he was worth $1 million. So reading and writing is not necessary to making money. Tain't necessary. Henry Ford went to the sixth grade. Thomas Edison went to the third grade. They weren't illiterate, but they weren't well-educated. Both of them multimillionaires. Boys and girls, sit back, relax. Just because somebody doesn't go to school doesn't mean that he's going to be on welfare. To my knowledge, there are no college graduates in the entire Amish community. Now, there may be. I can't tell you that there are no Amish, but if you know of an Amish man that has a degree from college, would you let me know? In fact, I'll give you a better one. If you can send me the name and address of an Amish man who has a high school diploma, let me know, would you? Now listen to this. Every once in a while, there's a farm auction. When the Amish want to buy a farm, they go to the auction, and they bid just like everybody else, in Federal Reserve note dollars. And if the Amish man wins the bid, he opens an attaché case and pays $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000, whatever the price is, in $100 bills. Those people have more $100 bills. They're the only people that have more $100 bills than the Amish are the drug dealers in Colombia. So, you know, boys and girls, sit back, relax. Not having an education is not going to impact. It isn't going to impact upon your ability to make money. Now, the people that are in San Quentin, the people that are in prisons, these people can all read and write. They've all got high school diplomas. Many of them do, most of them. Many of them have college degrees. And here they are ending up in prison. Now, pay attention here. Let's try it again. See if we can connect these dots. Should anybody, in making such an estimate, find the profits exceedingly small in proportion to the investment, let him not convert that fact into an argument against education itself, but only against this anti-parental system of education, a system which, being conceived in crime, brought forth in crime, and nurtured in crime, must of necessity propagate crime, hoping that someone better versed in figures than ourselves will solve for us the problem above. We shall now proceed to show how it is that our educated boys find their way into the penitentiary in the first place. Here, we will suppose, is an honest, industrious, hard-working, laboring man who has a family consisting of himself, his wife, and half a dozen children, half girls and half boys. To put the case in as favorable an aspect as possible, we will suppose that he is in moderately good circumstances, being out of debt and the owner of a comfortable homestead, but is compelled to rely solely on his own labor and that of his wife for means wherewith to feed and clothe his family. Now, all of his children are of an age to attend school, and all are attending the public schools as the law directs. Now, in the first place, heavy and frequent drafts are made on the father's scanty and hard-earned resources in order to supply these children with all of the required books and stationery. These six children, too, must each and all be dressed not according to the means of their parents, but according to the rules of the school and the demands of fashion, and inasmuch as the more wealthy and aristocratic classes prescribe the law of fashion, they must dress as well as the children of the man who counts his wealth by the millions. And if they do not so dress, they will have to encounter not only the contemptuous sneers of their fellow pupils and their classmates, but perhaps the displeasure of the teachers as well, if not expulsion from school. Now, this father would reason and perhaps remonstrate with the teacher on the subject of these rigid and extravagant rules of dress, but then he remembers that the law has said that the teacher of a public school is not the agent of the parent, nor answerable to him for his conduct toward the pupil. He also remembers that the law makes it criminal for a parent to insult a teacher, while the teacher may insult the parent with impunity. And for these reasons, he does not care to risk an altercation with the teacher on the subject of the boy's dress. It would be too unequal a contest. So in order to meet these growing demands for books, stationery, and clothing for their children, these poor parents are compelled to work harder, dress lighter, and feed more scantily than is comparable with either health or comfort. The father rises early in the morning, or earlier in the morning than formerly, works later at night, and goes with worn-out, ragged, or patched-up clothes in order that his eldest boy may get a new suit so as to make as respectable an appearance as any lad in the Lincoln School. The mother, too, is worn out in tattered apparel, plies her washboard with unwonted vigor in order to get money to pay the dressmaker for fitting, cutting, and making Lizzie's nice new dress, for the teacher says she must not come to school looking like an old washerwoman's child. The daughter, too, is learning to play upon the piano, and of course it will not do for her to lend a helping hand towards washing either clothes or dishes, for the teacher says it will spoil the shape of her fingers and impair the delicacy of her sense of touch. So, as a result, both the father and mother work harder than slaves, dress coarser than beggars, in order that their children may enjoy the great advantage of our glorious free school system of education. Let's hear it for free education for all children in public schools, shall we? Now, in the meantime, these children are sitting in the same classes, studying the same books, wearing the same costly fabrics, participating in the same amusements, contracting the same habits, imbibing the same love of ease, and the same aversion to manual labor, and the same contempt for manual laborers as do their far more wealthier and aristocratic school fellows. Leaving out of sight the five younger children, we shall now give our undivided attention to the eldest son of this poor laborer. After years of study, he at length completes his course at the Lincoln High School, acquitting himself with great honor, amidst the cordial congratulations of professors and school directors, and eliciting the vociferous applause of the admiring multitude. We may imagine that we see this poor old father crouching on the outskirts of the crowd, feasting his eyes upon an occasional glimpse of his boy, but not daring to approach him because he has no clothes fit to be seen on such an occasion. Doubtless that father is picturing to himself a brilliant future for his boy. He is perhaps looking forward to the time when he shall be a governor, a senator, or possibly president of the United States. Very likely, too, he fancies that in his declining years he shall be able to look to his son for that assistance and support which his own exhausted means may then refuse to afford him. But alas, how baseless are all of these castles in the air. The day after quitting school, the young man finds himself for once thrown on his own unaided resources. His father says to him, "Well, my boy, I have been a long time struggling with poverty and want in order that you might become educated. You see that both your mother and I are in rags, and that handsome suit which you now wear is yet to be paid for. You now have a fortune in your education, and hereafter you must learn to shift for yourself, and if possible, lend a helping hand from time to time to the support of your younger brothers and sisters." Hey, does that remind you of these young people who come out of college with this humongous college debt? Yeah, the parents who put themselves in debt to put their children through school, they finally came to an end. Parents can no longer afford to put their children through college. So now we have to have these student loan programs. And we do. And so now the students themselves put themselves into poverty. And sometimes for 25 or 30 years. I have students that are 50 years old still paying on their student loans. 50 years old, and they're still paying on their student loans, boys and girls. This guy, Zach Montgomery, was way ahead of his time in laying out this story and the privation that it takes to put this child through school and to educate him. And what is the product that comes out of this public school after all of the sacrifice and the self-sacrifice of the parents, and now even of the students themselves? We'll take that up next time on the Law Hour, an editorial review. What happens when these students graduate from school? Well, I've got to remind you that you have been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 112 countries daily over the internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-profit, non-sectarian law school and is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. If you'd like more information, go to our website, georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.